And greetings, greetings and blessings, blessed souls. Here we are now. It's now the 203rd class of Soul Quest in Search of Ancient Authentic Torah, installment number 50. We continue to vibe out on Genesis 2:17. But of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat of it, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. So let's just turn down the music one moment. That's, of course, Isaac Bitton's Here Comes the Time from his Generation Redemption album. And I just pull it down a little bit. Thank you, Rev Isaac. Okay. And just to let everyone know, as we try to turn off the music completely, sorry about that, that, in fact, we want to ask some questions about that verse in Genesis 2:17, blessed souls, which we will do, hope we will try to answer, not totally, but to arouse your Tzelem Elohim, your divine image, which is intimately connected with your human intellect, which is configured intimately with your divine image. So that tree of good and evil, let's ask some questions now and just think about it, and hopefully by the end of the show, we can come up with some points of reasoning, which will be seasoning for the soul. So what was that tree all about? Question number one. Number two, how do we as human beings relate to the instruction not to eat of a certain tree in our days? And how does the tree of life, in contrast to the tree of knowledge of good and evil, relate to human psyche, as we mentioned before, directly configured to our divine image? So please stay tuned, blessed souls, as we also plan to vibe out on Chabad and Breslov Chassidus. Of course, discussions will point us in the direction of Rambam, Rabbi Moshe, and Maimonides, from the books The Path of the Righteous Gentile and Compassion Towards Humanity in the Jewish Tradition, plus a surprise announcement, which hopefully I think will arouse a lot of hearts, hint, hint, pun intended, but you'll have to stay tuned to listen to what that surprise announcement will be. Plus, there are surprises that might even come as a surprise to ourselves, as we humbly try to present meditations, teachings, reasonings, seasonings for the soul when we are on live radio, as our hopefully our humble efforts will hopefully testify towards enlivening other blessed human souls. And one person engaging in enlivening blessed souls as a teacher and a student and an advocate and an advocate for the dissemination of the teachings of Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, Maimonides, Rambam, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, Dennis.
Boker Tov, Don.
Boker Tov, good morning to you, Dennis. Dennis, we have a dilemma here on Soul Class. There's so much to talk about, we can't compact it into one show. So I'm going to pray to the Almighty that we be freed up a little bit in whatever ways that should take, of course, in a proper way, in a peaceful way, in a pleasant way, that we should do more than one show a week, which means that there should be certain blessings of bounty upon all of us and all those participating in the show, because I love doing this, and my attitude of gratitude is surely coming down for a landing, is hopefully becoming more and more a part of my way of life. And I just want to thank you publicly for your continued participation. And this is our 50th installment. I don't recall if you began with our first installment in Search of Ancient Authentic Torah, but I just want to publicly express my gratitude to you, sir, that you continue like a soldier in the field to wave the flag for elevating the human meditative, and cognitive, emotional, and soulful experience.
Thank you, Don. And you're cooking with gas, too.
Well, hopefully the gas won't come from fracking. Anyway, Dennis, I know the concept we're going to talk about now is something that certainly tickles your spiritual palate, and it's an issue you'd like to address because you are a student and a teacher of Rambam's teachings, and let's go right into it. Talking about moon landing and Torah. Now, this was a letter that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, may his merit protect us, this is from the 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Nachum Schneerson, wrote to someone on May 8th, 1961, which would have corresponded to the Hebrew calendar year of 5721. And he wrote the following, and then let's get some feedback from Dennis. Greetings and blessings. I received your letter on April 24th, in which you wrote about the apparent contradiction between the latest scientific efforts to penetrate outer space, especially reaching the moon. And let's remember, let me just say parenthetically, blessed souls, you know, we take it as a given that man landed on the moon, but 1961, it was still a desire to get there because man would not reach there until the summer of 1969. Going back to the letter, that the Rebbe mentioned that this person had written to him about the contradictions between scientific attempts to penetrate outer space, especially reaching the moon, which seems to you to contradict the statement in the Torah, which is actually to be found in Psalms chapter 115, verse 16, quote, "The heavens belong to God, and the earth he gave to the children of men," end of quote. Actually, there's no contradiction at all. If you consider the term earth, not in the narrow sense referring only to our globe, but in its proper sense, as meant in this verse, which includes also the atmosphere and the entire physical universe, which humankind, mankind, womankind, whatever you want to say, is concerned and directly affected by. We must not confuse the terms heaven and the planets. The stars, the planets, moon, etc., are not called heaven, since heaven is something spiritual, whereas those planets are physical and belong in the physical universe. The fact that God created the so-called heavenly bodies to serve our world and to give light, to give warmth and energy to it, and placed them in the firmament of the sky at a certain distance from our earth does not preclude or, let me just put it, not just, not does not preclude or does, it doesn't diminish or criticize man's attempt to learn all about them. Similarly, when the Torah states that God placed the moon in the sky so to give light on the earth, this does not exclude the possibility of man's landing on it in some future time, which eventually man would in 1969. The meaning of the verse, quote, "the heavens belong to God," etc., is in the sense that while God is everywhere, including the heavens, man must remember that he was placed in a physical universe, and we are part of this physical universe, and therefore must make the most of it as long as there is life on this earth. There is nothing in actual scientific experiments and accomplishments that contradict the Torah, nor is there such a possibility, since the Torah is the instruction of truth. Judging by your writing and background, I firmly hope that you are conducting your daily life in strict accordance with the Torah, which is called the Torahs of life, instructions of life, the law of life, and the mitzvahs whereby not only Jews but all human beings can live by, and that you attempt to make steady advancement along this road in compliance with the principle that all things of holiness should be on an upgrade. Dennis, heaven and earth. What's going on here? Why do people, not just since the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages, have this problem of confusing spirituality as being a contradiction to scientific endeavors?
That's because people are quibbling over words, Don. I myself don't put a lot of faith in words, but I do put absolute faith, my faith and belief, in the content, the meaning, and the intent of what the words were put together for. Because if you go after the words, you're quibbling about a language type of problem. But you shouldn't have a conflict between your faith and belief with language. God is there. God, I don't know what language he speaks, but it doesn't matter. If you don't feel it in your heart and soul and your mind with your faith and belief, then you're not with it. You are searching for some meaning of some words. So to me, there is no conflict, because even the Rambam, when he talks about the heavens, celestial bodies, etc., on a philosophical, not a theological level, he talks about the earth being part of the sublunar. Sublunar to him is everything below the heavens, because everything above is God's domain, even though he created everything below it. So he put humans in one domain and he's in another. We don't mix them. We don't say words are interchangeable between these things. The purpose, the intent, and the content is clearly separated. So we cannot use human terms to get involved in what God is, does, and will be. So therefore, there is no conflict unless you get down to the word level. And that's where people sometimes will start splitting hairs.
Thank you, Dennis. So you mentioned the word faith, and I'd like to go directly into a teaching about faith and how faith is actually connected to an attitude, which hopefully become a way of life for all human beings and the human family experience, the attitude of faith. And I'm going to pull out from a Hasidic teaching by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. And of course, I'd like to get your feedback, and also I'll give some counter feedback. So here we go. This is from a teaching from the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, where he says the following. Therefore, first of all, man ought to be happy and joyous at all times, and truly live by his faith in the Lord, in the God, who animates him and acts kindly toward him every moment. Be he who grieves and laments demonstrates that he has it somewhat bad and is suffering, and lacking some goodness, he's like a heretic, heaven forbid. That's why the trait of sadness was strongly rejected by the sages of truth. The truly faithful person, however, is not perturbed by any suffering whatsoever, and respect to all mundane matters, yes, and no are all the same to him in true equality. But to he to whom they are not the same demonstrates that he is just a type of person who acts for his or herself and loves himself to the extent of removing self from under, so to speak, the hand of the Creator, and to live a heathenless life because of his self-love. And that's why he desires the life of the flesh, for that is what he or she considers to be his or her good. For man's purpose in this creation is decreed from above to be that a person should be tested in trials on this earth to ascertain what is in that person's heart, whether he or she will turn his or her heart towards other gods, namely the passions of the body, which evolve from what is known as the sitra achor, the other side, meaning in opposition to holiness, meaning lack of sensitivity to God and the revelations of godliness. So a person is tested to see whether he'll go after his or her passions of the body, whether his or her desire is to live the true life which evolves from the living God. And although a person may be unable to achieve this, or whether his desire and wish is though he is unable to achieve it, to live the true life, one still must believe that one is truly living it, meaning we might not stand on the highest spiritual plateau, but we should believe that we're heading in that direction, and that all one's needs and everything related to him or herself truly evolve in their intricate details, not from those things which are emanating from unholiness, but everything ultimately is coming from the Most High. And there is a verse from Psalms and 37:23, which states, from the Lord or from God, by whom the steps of man are established. Dennis, what is your take on this?
Well, for one thing, humans are imperfect, and we cannot be perfect. So when you say should be joyous and happy throughout their lives, that's fine. But we must remember that there's also the opposite side. All humans are sentient beings. We have feelings. Those feelings vary from time to time. to think that we can be happy and joy 100% of our lives is an ideal that may never be achieved. However, that doesn't mean we can't live a good and good spiritual life. So there are little bumps in the road. We shouldn't make the big bumps. So let the little things take care of themselves. We do our best, and time will work out. As long as your faith is there and your belief is there, you shouldn't worry about the future, because you are capable of absorbing those little bumps and going on through life.
Thank you, Dennis. And by the way, I want the counter response I want to give is that in this teaching by the First Lubavitcher Rebbe, one must be very careful. So, for instance, we see someone sad in our congregation, within our family setting, in our community, in our job place. We're not to rebuke them saying, oh, you ye of little faith, because you're not happy. No, no, no. The intention of the teaching, as really all of the Torah teachings are, to educate oneself to hopefully reach the highest ideals of human dignity, human faith, human love of the Creator, human fear of the Creator, not to do anything that would break the connection between us and the Creator. So when you see someone who is sad, get off your spiritual chair, your spiritual duff, as we might say, taking it to the street type of language, and try to encourage them to look at the brighter side. And I think, Dennis, that's the spirit of that teaching, is that, yes, there will be times, heaven forbid, we shouldn't know of such things. I mean, I'll give you an example. When I lost my grandparents, it was a sad time. So no one of any normal intellect would have expected me to start dancing in joy. Oh, my parents just passed away. No, of course, there are. King Solomon talks about the idea that there are times for joy and there's times for sadness. But the sadness, which is what would be considered, according to Torah teachings, one should be sad if one has lost a loved one. And again, may Hashem protect us, that we should not have to experience that. Rather, we should go right into the universal redemption and see that we go from strength to strength and joy. But I just wanted to point that out, that this teaching is not to turn us into finger pointers, Dennis, at someone who's maybe not happy, but to empower us. If we're truly happy, you know, Dennis, let me put it this way. Let me get your feedback on this. The litmus test of how joyous we are is, can we bring joy into other people's lives? What's your comment on that?
Well, my comment is that you say sadness. Let's take it one step further, maybe I exaggerate it a little bit, and take crying.
Right.
Crying is not a bad thing. It's the tearing and the tear ducts that's there naturally. So therefore, we can cry. If you're going to say crying is a form of sadness, okay, I don't care. You can stretch the meaning of the word. But the thing that gets me about crying sometimes is that when we have someone who dies, who we loved and we respected, and they die, and for some reason or other we start crying because they're gone. Yes, it is a loss, but at the same time, we must remember we are here to be born, live, and die. Die is a given. So therefore, when someone dies, to cry is a little hard to say that you're becoming emotional because our faith and our belief is that we will die. However, to me, and I take this personally, that if you're going to cry and you think I lived a bad life, please continue to cry, because I'll probably burn in hell then.
God forbid.
It's God forbid, but God sets these things and we must expect them. So that if somebody dies and they lived a good life, I would expect people to be happy and joyous about it. No sense crying, because if you're going to go to heaven, that's the purpose why we're here on earth, for the test we're going through. But if you think that I'm going, or somebody didn't live a good life, then I can understand the crying. So here we have, you love somebody and you're crying, you're sad. But at the same time, if they're going to heaven, that should be joyous and happy.
True. Well, there's, you know, also we have to, let's remember, there are tears of joy. Coming to a being at a wedding, seeing one's child graduate from high school, college, graduate school, doctor, whatever it may, a joyous moment. In fact, the Talmudic teachings indicate that crying out of joy is actually healthy for the eyes, but crying too much over sadness can actually have a negative effect on us. But there will be times when we cry out of pain. But that crying out of pain, it's explained actually in the inner dimensions of Torah, and I don't know if you've come across any teachings by Rambam. Crying is basically an overloading of the cognitive thought process, where a person stops to the processing cognitively that which is transpiring before his or her eyes, whether it be physical or spiritual, and therefore the tear ducts open and the salty water tears come pouring down the face. So I think that, you know, tears is a very, very is a very big subject in Torah, and in fact there is a prophecy that eventually the Most High is going to be removing the tears off the faces of people. Now obviously I don't think the Most High has any reason why to remove tears of joys from our faces, but tears of sadness and pain and whatever negative scenario, whatever scenario we might portray in our minds of why a person would cry for reasons other than joy, these tears shall have to be removed because there's been a prophecy about them that they shall be removed. But I just want to, before we move into the next section, I just want to get your feedback.
I just want to say something about what you said. You defined it, I don't think you meant to do it, but it came out and you said moments of joy. We must remember we deal with joy in moments. Why? Because it doesn't last too long. So can we get enough joy to get over those little speed bumps that are not joyous?
Well, again, that's for each person to experience. You know, we can't, you know, again, many teachings in Torah and other spiritual systems and even philosophical and psychological teachings are very axiomatic. You know, we have a saying in the mental health field that when we encounter a new client with a diagnosis, well, it says such and such and such a thing about a schizophrenic or bipolar or manic depressive, we have to, knock our heads and say, remember, guys, the person we're working with, that diagnosis, that's only for billing. They don't read the diagnosis, generally speaking. They're living their lives. So, you know, when we're talking about these, you know, what can joy do at any one moment, we have to go through the laboratory of our own experiences, and I think part of normal human socialization processes and healthy bonding among human beings is to share how we were able to get over a certain situation by virtue of, in this particular case, joy. But I want to get your feedback, and it's just as a matter of, because I'd like to pick your brain on this matter, wouldn't it be that the expression of how joyous a lifestyle we're living, regardless of economic considerations, be according to how much we're able to bring joy to other people and uplift their lives?
It isn't so much that we can bring joy, but we bring them hope for a positive future. We cannot undo what happened in the past, and you're living life today as is, and that can't be changed because it's reality. What we can do is hopefully to bring people to understand what their future should be so that it brings more purpose to their life. Everybody asks, why am I here? What am I doing? How come I'm doing this? How come I'm not doing something else? Well, God has a plan, and we are part of it. We place our faith and hope in the future that our plan will satisfy, not so much satisfy, but we will be able to understand it. And that understanding is through God's light, eyes, and meaning to help us cope with the future. Because if you don't understand what the future is and you don't feel like you're part of it, there's not going to be any joy in Mudville.
True. So, Dennis, before we move on to our section on the Rambam, I came across a beautiful poem by Exiled, our friend from down south. And he wrote a poem, and I'm looking forward to getting your feedback on this. It's called Don't Chain Your Heart. And we're going to read it now, and then hope we'll get some feedback from you. And by the way, if anyone wants to call in to give their feedback after I read the poem, you can do so by calling in at 1-347-838-8669. That's 1-347-838-8669. 888-368-8669, but please don't call while I'm reading the poem, because I won't be able to see you're calling in. Wait till after the poem if you want to call in to express your comments, questions, concerns about anything we've talked about before reading this poem, about the poem, or about any discussions which will follow our discussion of the poem. So here we go. This is by Exiled. It's called Don't Chain Your Heart. Don't chain your heart just to prove your mind is free. Don't complicate the song. Love is a simple harmony. Love is a call. Love is a stand. Love is the only key to wisdom's dreaded stand. Love if you will, love if you are. Only love lives on rocky ground and high above the stars. Don't chain your heart just to prove your mind is free. Don't complicate the song. Love is a simple harmony. New prophets hear my song. Mystics hear my plea. Children hold my hand as I rest beneath this tree. Never fall behind just to dim your light. Never move ahead just to bid your time. A time set for peace. A time set for light. A time to search inside away from man-made signs. Love is the tie that binds, a knot forever entwined. Love is all. Love is the none. Free for all or none to find. A light so very bright, a truth strong and deep. Love makes her rounds as reasons fall asleep. Still hand in hand, faith will sow and reap. One source in the garden, come fell the mighty tree. Don't change your heart just to prove your mind is free. Don't complicate the song. Love is a simple harmony. No, never chain your heart just to prove your mind is free. Dennis, your take on the poem.
Chain your heart. That's putting restrictions, chains, on your heart. To me, if you want to live and understand life, you got to have an open heart and an open mind. If you don't, you are short-sighting yourself and not using your full capabilities and properties that the good Lord has given us when he created us here. So you must, and I'll take the opposite view of the poem, do not change your heart. I'm saying open your heart. Try it. Trust in yourself. Your mind and your heart can be expanded to understand what humanity is about and what spirituality is. You can't lose.
Amen. Amen. So there's, I'm just going to now ask you to please pull out Moses Maimonides, Physician, Scientist, and Philosopher, edited by Dr. Raza and Dr. Samuel Kotick. And where shall we turn to today, sir, to discuss a teaching from or about Rambam?
Well, Don, we're going to go back to where we left off last week, and I'd like to repeat one portion of what I read last week, and that is page 129. The second of these things, and it's in quotes, they are included among those who deny the Torah.
Right.
Bring us quite naturally to the passage of the code, Hilak Tavusha 3.8, where Maimonides defines the term deniers of the Torah. Three classes of people, and this is from the Guide to the Perplexed. Three classes of people are deniers of the Torah. He who says that the Torah is not divine origin. Two, he who denies its interpretation, that is, the oral law. Three, and he who says that the Creator changed one commandment for another. Everyone belongs to any of these classes is a denier of the Torah. It follows necessarily that any person who holds that the words of the Torah exist to cure the body must be assigned to one of these three categories. The only possible category under which it is reasonable to classify such a person, only the first, he who says that the Torah is not of divine origin. That was in quotes. Mm-hmm. According to Maimonides himself, in the Guide to the Perplexed, 240, a divine law is one that addresses itself not only to the body and social perfection, but also to spiritual welfare. A person desirous of proving that his law is divinely inspired must therefore demonstrate that, in addition to the usual man-made laws, it contains provisions designed for the achievement of spiritual perfection in its adherence. Hence, any negation of the Torah's function of promoting the welfare of the soul is essentially equivalent to denying its divine origin. Maimonides' dogmatic ruling, and he quotes here, "They are included among those who deny the Torah," unquote, may be understood in the light of Maimonides' ascending scale of perfections as described in the guide, 354. 1. Perfection of possessions. 2. Perfection of bodily constitutions, end quote, in parentheses, health and strength. 3. Perfection of moral virtues. 4. Perfection of rational virtues.
Mm-hmm.
In chapter 5, the introduction.
Can I ask you a question for a second?
Sure.
Okay. Now, I understand this hierarchy, which I guess the highest level is perfection of rational virtues. Perfection of moral virtues would be what? A person's sense of understanding and hopefully internalizing the difference between good and evil, those things which are in the gray area between good and evil, and rational virtues. So my take on this, it should not be a contradiction between one's moral virtues and one's rational virtues. So let me ask you this, based on your learnings, why do you think that rational virtues are placed as a higher on the scale of hierarchy over moral virtues?
We must be able to control our rationalization and our interpretation that we do on a human level. So we are endowed with free will, but it must be controlled. It's not something that you use willy-nilly anywhere.
Right.
We have rules, regulations. When I was a kid, we learned between right and wrong. There was no gray area in between. Yet today, we hear of 50 Shades of Gray. It's a bestseller. They're going to make a movie about it. There are up to 50 variations. There shouldn't be any gray area. You're either right or you're wrong. To start coming in with rationalization and interpretation sometimes, oh, well, it's only a white lie and it didn't hurt anybody. Oh, that sounds so nice from a human viewpoint. But when it comes down to rationalization, you're eroding the base and the foundation of what is right and wrong.
Beautiful. Okay, then please continue.
Well, okay. Okay, it follows that necessary any person... Ooh, wait a minute, I'm sorry, I got to skip down.
In chapter 5,
is in his introduction to the Masonic Treatise Abiyat, Maimonides indicates that the ideal causal relationship between these perfections, the sole worthy object of the accumulation of wealth, is to ensure physical health, while a healthy body enables the soul to acquire perfection. In chapter 1 of the same work, Maimonides classifies the soul's faculties in accordance with the perfections they are intended to cultivate. Thus, the comparative intellect is aimed at acquiring perfection of rational virtues. Through the medium of practical intellect, one achieves skill in craftsmanship, such as carpentry, agriculture, and seamanship, which pertain to the perfection of possessions. Of medical skill, which is concerned with the perfection of the body constitution. The third of perfection, that of moral values, though not mentioned, is apparently the concern of the practical complementative intellect. The three areas of knowledge, too, are classified in Maimonides' Treatise on Logic, chapter 14. In accordance with the specific perfection, they are meant to cultivate. Thus, theoretical philosophy is concerned with rational perfection, the highest perfection of all. The various branches of practical philosophy aim at the perfection of moral virtues, while the perfection of possessions is the object of craftsmanship, such as stone-cutting, carpentry. The medical art, however, is not mentioned in this context. Should I go on, Don, or are we biting off more than we can assimilate?
No. I have a comment on one particular point, but please, I'd like you to continue.
Okay.
One more paragraph.
All righty. Running again to the introduction of Abiyat, chapter 5, we find Maimonides arguing for the superiority of medicine to other professions. Medicine is concerned directly with the body, unlike carpentry and weaving, for example, whose objective is the acquisition of possession. And through its medium, a person can demonstrate how best to employ the body efficiency in the service of the soul. Medicine offers a rational criteria for the choice of material sustenance. He should be governed by his choice of the beneficial effect of specific foods on his health, not by his base desires or appetite.
Okay. Thank you, Dan. So there's two points I'd like to just, because there's just so much information. I hope everyone who is listening in, whether live or the arc or eventually the archive version, remember this type of show, you can, with your cursor, pull back and replay parts which might seem to be overwhelming in terms of the volume of knowledge. Before we continue, guys, we're going to bring on now Noah Haid Chassid, Ron Williams. We got it. We're pulling him in. Oh, and we lost him. I'll have to call back. That was a problem from our side. But then there's one thing that I noticed here, where Rambam talks about the whole idea of the soul worthy object of the accumulation of wealth is to ensure physical health. Oy vey, I would say, meaning, oh my, that unfortunately in Western culture, or let's not be so negative about Western culture, let's say human culture, unfortunately too many people have accumulated wealth not for the sake of ensuring their physical health, but for the sake of feeding their egos in an unhealthy way. And yet the Rambam's saying, and of course the Rambam is within the context of a teaching of Mishnah from the Pirkei Avot, the ethics of our fathers, is saying that it is a Torah perspective not to negate the ideal of accumulating wealth, but to use the wealth to improve your physical health. And at that point, once has improved one's physical health, one is enabling the soul to acquire perfection. The other thing in your concluding statement here was that it should be that medicine offers man a rational criteria for the choice of material sustenance. He should be governed by his choice by the beneficial effect of specific foods on his health, not by his base desires or appetite. Now, this matter is addressed, in fact, by Rambam in the laws of repentance, talking about not only will a person have to eventually address those issues of doing wrong, which are obviously wrong, not only to human intellect, but according to Torah teachings, but one will have to take into account if they lived a gluttonous lifestyle, whether it be eating physically or spiritual gluttony, indulging in matters in a gluttonous fashion. So it's very interesting that the way of Torah is not to reject physical living, because as we mentioned in the letter of the Baba Tzur Rebbe, we are living in a physical universe, and action is the essence of a person expressing his or her testimony to who they are in the creation with the Creator, of course acknowledging their faith in the Most High and sharing experience with other people. But here we see that Rambam is stating that we're not here just, if we're going to be as spiritual beings, we're not here to be wrapped up in loincloth, sitting on the top of a mountain, chanting out whatever we might be chanting out, but to live, to engage in physical living, which is part of our, surprise, surprise, living on this physical earth. Dennis, any comments?
Yes,
Don.
He mentions possessions. Possessions, in this case, are all our God-given talents. We all have some talent somewhere about something. Nobody was created talentless. So we have possession, our mind, art, and everything else that's in our genes and chromosomes. So you must protect what you have, because a lot of people believe your body is a sanctuary of God. So therefore, if you want to call it the form that was given to us, it's ours. It's your possession. You are responsible. Use it well. The other point I'd like to make is an old moral adage. What good does it do a man who has accumulated all the wealth in the world and cannot enjoy it?
True. Dennis, I'd like to now read as an afterthought, but I think it's very important to give our listeners a context by which they can better understand who Rambam is and why someone like yourself and myself and thousands, if not millions of other people across the globe are becoming more and more interested in learning the teachings of Rambam. And so we're going to go into a little historical background of Rambam now, and then, of course, I'd love to hear your comments on basically I'm going to be reading one, two, three paragraphs. So here we go. Maimonides Rambam, who Dennis just read about, and his viewpoints. Maimonides was the last and the foremost figure of, quote-unquote, the golden age of Jewish learning in Spain. His was the most comprehensive mind of medieval Jewry, and he was, after the Masters of Talmud, the greatest Jewish personality to emerge. He reached the loftiest heights possible for his time, and indeed for centuries after his time, he strove to build up the spiritual ramparts of Judaism so as to make it more them impervious to attack. Almost single-handedly, he brought about a revival of Jewish learning and a culture at a time when they seemed to be dying. Jews have paid no greater tribute to any man than they did to Moses ben Maimon, who they compared him to Moses ben Amram, which is the original Moses, the five books of Moses. Everyone remember that book, those five books? That Moses ben Maimon has been compared to Moses ben Amram, the man of God. His literary activity was incredible. His range of scholarship was encyclopedic. He was the most prolific of Jewish writers. He explored almost all knowledge and mastered nearly every science known to his age, which again, as the Rebbe mentioned before, Lubavitcher Rebbe, it shouldn't be a contradiction, and Rambam was the embodiment of seeing no contradiction between science in his age and the Torah up until that time. He gave to the world not only one magnum opus, but several. His scholarship encompassed the Bible and the Talmud, mathematics, astronomy, jurisprudence, ethics, philosophy, and medicine. And in everything to which he gave his mind, he attained outstanding results. He intruded himself into posterity, not intentionally, but I would say just a divine providence, because he was usually men of humility are the ones that truly reach positive posterity many years after his passing. In fact, today, more than 750 years after his passing, his achievements in Jewish thought and learning are still a vital force in the scarlet of thousands of Jews, and I want to add also in thousands of lives of scholarly individuals from the nations of the world. His appeal is universal. The only Jewish scholar whose prestige and influence extend far beyond the confines of his own people, Christian and Muslim theologians, which quote-unquote means critical thinkers, Christian and Muslim critical thinking theologians recognized and disputed with him. Yet it is impossible to read the works of the medieval schoolmen without finding approval or disagreement with Maimonides' teaching dominating their pages. He had the merit, a merit he shared with the greatest of his age, of imposing his convictions. He fought against resistance. He battled against ignorance, bigotry, and superstition. The kindest and most humble of men, his personality was combative and aggressive. He excited violent animosity. He was the victim of calumny, which I'm not exactly sure what that word means, I guess misfortune, and misrepresentation, but there was a quality in him which could not be ignored or set aside. He never suffered final defeat. Dennis, any take on this matter?
I'd like to issue a correction to that statement. Not a big correction, but a little twist. And that is what you wrote is a Jewish viewpoint of Maimonides. I'm sure if somebody wrote a similar thing regarding mankind, they would include all the things they would incorporate everything you said from a Jewish viewpoint, because he gave his mind, his thinking, to all humans. They used it, and they used it in many different ways. So you can evaluate it from a Jewish viewpoint, but he helped out mankind, and that is unique, because he still has his logic, his thinking, his philosophy, which everybody salutes because it's impeccable, and he did enhance the Jewish viewpoint and thought, because a lot of intelligence came out of Judaism over the years. It was only offered to Jews, but a lot of other people were using it. So, in effect, he was somebody who made an impression in his lifetime.
Well, Dennis, I'd like to agree. Before we go, I offer further feedback. We brought on, and I apologize to Noahide Custard, Ron Williams. Ron, I know you called in a couple minutes before. I tried to click you on, and we lost you, so I apologize for that.
No need to apologize, because I unfortunately plugged charged my phone, but the actual electrical outlet was not plugged in, so it was my fault. So it's my apology. Good morning, Dennis, Don. I came on here in the middle of your presentation about the Rambam, and I would like to just add to what Dennis just said. Brilliant, by the way, Dennis. What we call many times a Jewish viewpoint, or his work was offered to Jews. The thing is, his work is actually universal. The problem was that at that time it was classified only by as a Jewish type of work, and it was only because of the persecutions, that's the reason why many of the Jewish writings and thinking seem to appear specifically only for Jews. But nevertheless, the majority of their work, besides the specific halakha that they have to keep concerning their position of sanctity in the world, is for the entire world. So Rambam is only one of the many, who all they work basically universal. And this is one of the reasons why I'm so happy we have this show, because we're trying to explain to the world that what is termed Jewish is actually more universal than we think.
True. And I also want to mention that, remember...
Don?
Yes, Dennis.
I'd like to say that it's nice hearing Ron. His plug at home may not have enough juice, but his mentality on the program here does.
I just want to mention as well, let's remember, bless us, that all of us are descendants of original man and woman, Adam and Eve, who weren't Jewish, they weren't Christian, they weren't Muslim, they weren't even the children of Noah, they were the children of God directly, and we call ourselves, every person is a child of God, Ben Mokom, or Bas Mokom, as we say in Hebrew, because, you know, he wants us to think a little bit into these things. You know, unfortunately, when people get into linear forms of consciousness, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, if we skip to the Z, sometimes we get a little confused. So yes, I mean, I'm reading a book that's by Jacob Minkin. And, you know, we have to understand, and hopefully we can understand, as an example for all peoples, that, you know, Jewish psyche has been severely damaged, unfortunately, on a mass scale, over the past almost 2,000 years since we lost our sovereignty in the land. And even though there's a modern state of Israel, we really don't have true sovereignty in the land. It's more like more of a stewardship of sovereignty in the land of Israel right now. So these books, there are many teachings in Judaism to first raise up Jewish pride in being Jewish, and then say, hey guys, now that you have sufficient pride, not out of arrogance, but out of accepting this is your inheritance, now it's time to help the world. And that's also the message to all the nations of the world. Now that you've gotten your pride, whether it's a newly formed nation, like I know Jamaica is celebrating their 50th anniversary as a nation. Congratulations to Jamaica. Make Jamaica continue to go from strength to strength, and the new southern Sudan. And we only pray and hope that whatever's going on in Syria and Egypt would instantly be transformed into a peaceful rectification of those situations, which means a lot of people must repent over there. And let's not try to play high and mighty, Western perceivers of what's going on in the Middle East. In America, a lot of repentance has to take place. The whole world has to turn back to God. So with that being said, Basils, let's remember that Torah thinking is not Jewish thinking. It's thinking which is the thinking of the Most High that he's transmitting to us through our feeble, yet it's all we have to work with, our human language. Our human language with all its foibles, all of its weaknesses. It's what we have to use in order to communicate a sense of our perception of the Most High and his plan for the creation. Dennis, Ron, any comments? Counter feedback.
When Maimonides was growing up as a young kid, he was in an atmosphere where you had many different religions all working together, the knowledge, understanding. They all believed in God, and they all went about it the best way they could to to create that understanding, that basis. And it served him well, because he ends up calling in the Guide to Perplexed other religions as co-religious. Well, it's not a rabbinical document, but it is a very, very strong philosophical document when he can accept other religions as co-religious. So to me, that was a heartfelt thing, that I felt that this man was above most other people, because he was a person of inclusiveness. He wanted everybody to think about God. And that was his fervent purpose. It's if you could think about God, whether you're a scholar, whether you are uneducated, and everything in between, that if you could think about God, your mind, your soul, and your heart would bring about a change in you.
Beautiful. Dennis, and Ron, before you make any comments, if you wish to, we're bringing in now Booker T. Washington, President, and Noahide Cartrell Gore. Good morning, Cartrell.
Booker Tom hovering.
Good morning.
Cartrell, we have Ron and Dennis on the line as well.
Good morning.
Hi there. I need Noah about Lot, correct, Ebris.
What Cartrell said is that he's a son of Noah, but he doesn't read Hebrew. That's okay. Your English communicates deep wisdom and empowers other human beings. And there's one reason why we're speaking English, because the Most High in his wisdom has allowed human beings to use this language to fellowship as we are. So, Ron, any other further takes on this last topic we've been discussing about the universality as it applies to Torah teachings?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to add to that is this. The only document that was actually communicated from God to man is the Torah. There aren't any other documents. And I'm very confident because of the sources in which it came from. And Maimonides brought his thinking from that document. When you study the Torah, that document that was communicated from God to man on Mount Sinai, what happens is it has an effect on you in terms of it refines you, because now you're thinking the thoughts that the Most High had given over to us. Understand? And even though you will tolerate other religions and other ideas, the main thing is the idea of the Torah is divine, and being divine, it supersedes man's thinking. So other religions may be co-religious because of you have to accept it, but nevertheless, the thought that was communicated from God to man precedes them all. And what we have to do now is we have to reveal that type of thinking to mankind in general. Whether you're Hindu, Muslim, Christian, it matters not, because God's message is universal.
Mm-hmm. Cartrell, let me ask you a question. Since you've integrated within your lifestyle the consciousness of a son of Noah, a Noahide, a promoter of the seven Noahide commandments, do you feel your outlook has become more universal in perspective, and it's easier to relate to more people coming from different backgrounds?
I was raised not to be prejudiced or against people because of their race or religion. I was also taught the Ten Commandments as a small child. And along with the Golden Rule, I have tried to get along with different types of people. Now, I show respect for most people, because I believe most people do deserve respect. There are some people who actually do not deserve respect. I've been thinking that unfortunately, when I was listening to the news, I am hearing too much bad news about Muslims in particular. For example, on Christmas Day, some Muslims in Nigeria blew up a Christian church. That's very, very distressing. That's very, very distressing.
Yes.
I'm hearing too much bad news about one particular religion. I don't hear that much bad news about Hindus or Sikhs or Buddhists. I'm hearing a lot of bad news about Muslims. It's a pattern. Oh, yes, I can hear bad news about other groups, but the pattern is becoming overwhelming.
Well, I hear what you're saying, Coach Charlie, and I just want to respond that unfortunately there has been bad news about other religions or faiths, whatever you call them. I mean, the dark and slippery slope of pedophilia, unfortunately, has been a problem not just in the Catholic religion, but it's happened even in episodes. I hate to say it, but I have to say it for the sake of truth. It's a public matter. Even in the Jewish Orthodox community, there have been far too many incidents of pedophilia. So as far as rampant destruction and that, you know, that you talk about destroying a church, that for sure is not the way we want to go, and that's not the way we want to promote. You know, listen, there's going to be every faith has its own, not the faith itself, but the practice of the faith have their own dirty laundry, which they cannot hide, because everyone at one point has to allow their dirty laundry to hang out on the hanger, so to speak, not necessarily for other human beings to see, but the higher forces in creation, the creator's angels who are part of his system, the angelic system. One day, hopefully, we'll talk about that, the most angelic system, which are talked about all over the Torah and the prophets. But, Dennis, let's go to you now. The universal view, I mean, before you go into saying something, Dennis, I just want to mention that I am proud to say that, you know, and I want to testify that just because a person is not adhering openly to a Torah-based system or any type of spiritual system doesn't mean they're not in tuned to healthy values. And I'm proud to say that all my parents, because of circumstances which go way beyond the framework of this show, were not raised in the Torah atmosphere. I was raised in an atmosphere not to judge people by the way they look, but a person should be assessed based on their actions and not their words. And therefore, I am happy to say, growing up in middle class, suburban, 99.99% Caucasian, middle class American, Paramus, New Jersey, I was raised not to be racist or to have prejudices against people, but rather to stand up for the dignity of human beings. So I just want to mention that you know, not all people who, just because they haven't had access to openly in a way that they could internalize it and live by it, spirituality systems, they don't necessarily turn out to be bad apples. There are people who shine through their lack of knowledge of the teachings of the Most High and able to be actually decent human beings, for whatever reasons, which only divine providence will be able to address to us in the future, hopefully with the coming of the Mashiach, explaining to us why these things happen this way. Dennis, your take on how were you brought up to have a universal outlook on life?
Well, let me explain. You mentioned pedophilia a minute ago. Pedophilia is not a religious problem. It's a human problem. It's been going on probably for a long time, like prostitution. Yes, people are not perfect. However, it's the religions that tell you the difference between right and wrong. So, just like what Terrell said when he was growing up, and me as well, the Ten Commandments were drilled in our heads, and that became a standard for a reference point. It doesn't explain everything, but at least you understand the basics between right and wrong. If you didn't, or you want to ignore them, that's your folly. You can go ahead and do whatever you feel like. You have a free will. But at some point in time, you're going to be responsible, and you're going to be held to that responsibility. Now, the other thing is, universality is a nice word, but sometimes it's a human joke. Why? And not to denigrate what you brought up at all, Don, is that when I was told, you got to be nice to that other person, even though they look differently, you got to be nice to them. Well, I thought that was nice of adults to tell me that. But whenever they got mad, Oh, my gosh, what came out of their mouth? I think they forgot what they told me. They were practicing two-face. And one time they were saying, oh, you got to be nice to your fellow man. And in other times when they get mad, they start cursing them, they start picking out the differences, and they denigrate these other people. So I learned by listening to adults and how they behave that, yes, it's very easy to be two-faced, but if you can't control your emotions, how can you keep up the principles that you should be living in?
Beautiful. So anyway, we reach actually the halfway point. I want to play now as a segue to the second half of the program, a song that probably Cartrell and Dennis know very well. Ron, you might not have heard this song because this came out in 1972, but was actually written in 1954. The song is called Black and White. It's a song written by David I. Erkin and Earl Robinson. And the most successful recording of the song was done in the pop version by the Three Dog Night, what actually became a number one song in the top 100 charts in America at that time. That's 40 years ago. Now, it's what I didn't know, and this was provided to me via YouTube, is that this song was actually inspired by the United States Supreme Court decision of Brown versus Board of Education that outlawed racial segregation of public schools. And the original song was, again, first recorded by Sammy Davis Jr. I tried to find it. Unfortunately, I couldn't get his version. If I can find that Sammy Davis Jr. version of Black and White, I'd love to play it at a future show. And the lyrics, which you won't hear on this song, actually were much more biting. And I'd just like to read these lyrics before we segue into the song. Quote, this is referring to the justices who ruled in favor of ending, thank God, racial segregation in public schools. Quote, their robes were black, their heads were white, the schoolhouse doors were closed so tight. Nine judges all set down their name to end the years and years of shame. And that was written by David Erkin and Earl Robinson. You won't hear in the song now, but this song is going to go for about 3 minutes and 48 seconds. Enjoy, everyone. Dennis and Cartrell, we're going back 40 years, back before all of us had some gray hair and gray in our beards. And Ron, maybe you've heard the song, maybe you haven't, but enjoy, everyone. Here we go. Black and White by Three Dog Night.
Child is black, child is white.
That was Three Dog Night, Black and White. Dennis and Carson, remember that song when it came out?
Yes.
Yes.
40 years ago.
Yeah. Ron, did you ever hear that song before?
Yes. I was born in 68, so I grew up actually in the 70s. And back home, we had a lot of old music playing from America before the split when we became communists. So I heard that before, yes.
Okay.
Well,
gentlemen, yes.
I just want to mention one thing here, Todd. That brought back memories to me of an old Star Trek series way back then. And that was the Enterprise was called to this planet because it was exploding and the people were killing each other, et cetera, et cetera. Two people were beamed up onto the Enterprise. These people had one side black, one side white.
Right.
What happened?
I remember the episode. I remember the episode. Yeah.
Two people were arguing they wanted to kill each other. So finally,
right.
Big Kirk said, wait a minute, what are you fighting about? You're both half white, half black. And the guy explained it to him. It was very simple. That person over there was black on the right side. I'm black on the left side. Human folly has no end. If you can't understand what is right and wrong, you're stuck, and you're going to invent nonsense in your head, rationalize and interpret things that don't need it.
True. Thank you, Dennis. Gentlemen and Blessed Soul, as a public service, I feel it's my duty to share just for the next couple minutes before we move on with the other sections of the program, based on what I feel is a very inspiring group, which only has 81 members, and as I just wrote to the person who monitors the website, Roger Oberlin, who sometimes has appeared on our show, I think two or three times, from Alliance, Ohio. It's called Health, Eating Raw and Organic. And inspired by that teaching, or the teachings that go on, and I'd like to invite anyone who's connected with Facebook, just type in health-eating raw and organic, and you can get some very nice health tips on eating properly and what foods to avoid. And speaking of what foods are, in particular, additives to avoid, I feel as a public service, I should share with you the following information, which I took off of an article by David Zenko with Matt Goulding. And we're not going to go through all these, but I think on a weekly basis, we're going to go through 8 ingredients you never want to see on your nutritional label. The first one would be BHA. And this preservative is used to prevent rancidity in foods that contains oils, because oil will go rancid. Unfortunately, BHA, which is also known in its extended chemical name, butylated hydroxyanisole, has been shown to cause cancer in rats, mice, and hamsters. And the reason the FDA hasn't banned it is largely technical. The cancers all occurred in the rodents' four stomachs, an organ that humans don't have. Nevertheless, the study published in the Japanese Journal of Cancer Research concluded that BHA was, quote, reasonably anticipated to be a carcinogen, unquote, and as far as I'm concerned, that's reason enough to eliminate it from your diet. So there's a health tip, Blessed Souls, and unfortunately, BHA is found in great, in great bounty, unfortunately, it's a negative type of bounty, in children's cereals. So why should we expose our children to this preservative, which has been shown to be carcinogenic in the four stomachs of rats? Gentlemen, any comments about healthy eating habits or about what I just read?
Yes, what happens is in the last 100 years in processing foods, we have been introducing all sorts of chemicals, and a lot of them are not on the label, but you must use common sense, because we are what we eat. What you put in your mouth, your body has to live with. If you are putting in stuff that was created in a laboratory for laboratory purposes or for greedy purposes in people who process food, then it's your fault for not being aware of that. The closer you are to the natural food, the better off your body is going to be. The natural food was what our body was designed for. So if you want to eat a lot of chemicals, And just to give you an idea, there's certain types of meat products that are allowed to have 35% non-meat additives. Well, good luck with your 35%. I hope you enjoy it, because your body certainly doesn't.
Thank you, Dennis. Ron, any take on this, on how we should try to stay away from additives such as BHA?
I think once certain products get FDA stamp of approval, we feel that, you know, they're overseeing, you know, our health interests. And unfortunately, many times it's not the case. And new studies are constantly revealing the fact that many of the so-called FDA-approved products are not very good for us, actually not good at all for us. MSG is still part of most seasonings, and they're, you know, commonly used in restaurants. There's a lot of food in taste enhancers, which basically applies to our brain as opposed to just our taste. And they make us mildly addicted to the food. And there's no warning against this. It's really, you know, by the FDA, you know, it's approved. It's in all our seasonings on every shelf that you can find in the supermarket. So my only advice is that we should do our own research. We've been given a great tool, the internet, where we can, you know, really investigate and make our choices. And as Dennis said, we consume processed foods, then we have to remember we are basically placing ourselves at risk.
I hear you. Cartrell, any thoughts on this matter of healthy eating habits and not just eating the right foods, but staying away from the negative foods or the negative additives? Cartrell? Maybe we lost Cottrell here. He's on, but apparently he's busy with something. Okay, so gentlemen and blessed souls out there, we're going to now move on to the next section, taking from actually the last of the 48 attributes of how to acquire, or so to speak, internalize the Torah, according to the teachings of Perkei Avot, the Ethics of Our Fathers, which we talked about earlier from Chapter 5, and Dennis read from the writings about Maimonides, Rambam. And this is called, and by the way, we'll hopefully have a special surprise announcement, where we're going to pick up in terms of continuing to teach Rabbi Nachman and integrating a new teaching, hopefully with next week's show. So the last of the 48 attributes in terms of acquiring the Torah is Ha'omer Davar B'Shem Omro, meaning a person who says something in the name of the person who originated this teaching. Now, the source for this is actually based on an occurrence which you can learn about Blessed Souls in the Book of Esther. Now, what happened in the Book of Esther is that there was an attempt to murder King Ahasuerus, who at that time was the king of Persia. Now, what happened was Mordechai, the righteous one, who understood all the languages of the creation of each nation, related that to Esther, who was already by that time Queen Esther, married to King Ahasuerus, and she told, and it says here in the verse in the Book of Esther, chapter 2, verse 22, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordechai the fact that two of the king's servants were trying to kill him by poisoning his drink, and he had them hanged. And eventually it was written in the Book of Chronicles, not the Hebrew Book of Chronicles, but the Persian Book of Chronicles. And at the beginning of chapter 6 of the Book of Esther, blessed souls, you can see that because Esther had it mentioned to the king that two people tried to kill him, that their plot was heard and understood and communicated to her by Mordechai, actually saved Mordechai's life. Not only saved the king's life, but would allow Mordechai to be promoted to a position which would lead to the downfall of the wicked Haman, the Amalekite, in order to save the Jewish people from the decree that Haman had in fact wanted to carry out, to destroy all the Jewish people in one day, in those days, in Persia, which not just meant Persia. Persia also ruled over 127 countries at that time, which is quite a lot. So Rabbi Nachman, though, wants us to understand the inner dimension of this teaching is that a person who says something in the name of the person who originated the teaching, that this truth is a foundation for all matters of acquiring the Torah. That we see that a truly righteous person, like say like the Rambam or Moses, a true righteous person is ready to give over his soul, give away his life to help the children of man, to bring them to the close to the Most High, and to penetrate within them a simple faith in him, may he be blessed, and to teach them Torah at the time that they're distanced away. And even though we see by the majority of people, Rabbi Nachman continues, that when a person is found in a state of lowliness and contracted consciousness, and they are more involved in just following their physical desires and their emotions, which are really not in sync with properly being configured to the human intellect, which should be properly configured to their divine image, that comes along a wise person and a very righteous person, and he's prepared to give away his life for the sake of that person who is so sunken in a constricted state of consciousness, is so sunken into their own personal desires. And what happens is that the righteous person comes along and teaches them the way of serving God and brings them out of their own spiritual pit of death, and that person was founded. So what we see that immediately that when a person gets broadened out and taken out of that spiritual death pit, that and they run and they seek the righteous. Sometimes they even leave the righteous person, the righteous teachings, and then speak bad about the negative person. But I'm sorry, but negative person, the righteous person. So we see here, blessed souls, that it's not about just saying, you know, in the name of who originated teaching that you find interesting. It's about having a little bit, and if not a lot of recognition of the goodness of the Creator that this person has been brought to, this righteous person, say like Rambam, has been brought to your attention to waken you up, to waken us all up, and I put myself, you know, along with the pack of people who've been woken up by the teachings of Rambam. Therefore, we feel it's our duty as part of our mission here, so to speak, on this program with our humble efforts, is to talk about things in the name of Rambam and other righteous teachers in order that we can help redeem other people from their sense of spiritual lowliness and they're being sunken in their desires to the point where they have unhealthy lifestyles, that they too should be empowered to help other people because of these teachings of, say, like the Rambam. Dennis, your thoughts on this teaching?
Well, to me, I got to simplify that, Don. And that is, if you have faith and belief, how strong is it? What level do you practice at? Do you believe in it, but you don't practice it too high? You practice it at a lower level? Does your conscience bother you? Do you feel like you believe in your religion so much that you're not willing to give up your life for it? We must answer these questions. They're personal. They're not public questions. You must understand yourself as to how far you are willing to take your faith and belief. So we judge you by how you practice it, not your intent that's in your head. So if you know all the ins and outs, the rights from the wrongs, the path should be clear. But you personally must be able to declare what level of practice do you believe in.
Ron, your take on this, on saying something in the name of the person who revealed a teaching to you.
All right. I think to me personally, it's more like giving, paying, like honor. I don't know if it's paying a tribute to the person or to show gratitude of what you've acquired from someone else. Because what I felt many times is that whenever you ask the creator for help, or when you don't know an answer, you know, how to make a certain decision, someone comes along and they may say something to you that really can inspire you if you really look into what they've said. And that was that's actually a message you received from the creator, an answer to your question. And whenever you remember to say something in the name of the person who mentioned to you, it's as if you pay a certain amount of respect to that person. And not only that, you also uplift that person in the eyes of the person whom you're speaking to now. And that's also bringing a good name for that person, as opposed to, you know, saying something disparagingly about a person. So that's many times how I see it.
Okay. Katra, as president of the Booker T. Washington Business League, have you seen how your sharing teachings by Booker T. Washington with other people has empowered them and brought them out of, so to speak, an intellectual pit or an emotional pit or even a spiritual pit to help them improve their lives? Cartrell? Oh, boy, I guess he's still engaged in something. I'm sorry. So we'll move on, and maybe if Cartrell comes back on live, we'll ask him that question. So, gentlemen, and blessed souls out there, we'd like to turn to... Oh, and okay, here comes the surprise announcement. Now, since we've concluded the 48 attributes of Rabbi Nachman, I think it would be very nice to share with you future teachings of Rabbi Nachman, not just to say, well, we think, because there's hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of his teachings available. Some of it's in English, most of it's still in Hebrew. There is a book that I have, I'm looking at it right now. It's called Erech Apayim, which is actually a description of one of the attributes of the Most High, which can be defined as the Most High is patient, or He is the source of all patience. And the Hasidic teachings, according to Breslov Hasidus, hopefully we'll be exploring on a weekly basis about the attribute of patience and how we humans will greatly benefit and greatly benefit other people by being just that, more patient with ourselves and others. And sometimes we even have to be patient with the Most High, not that He needs our patience, but that we should have patience, which seems to be sometimes when things don't go our way. And aside from that, also we hope to be integrating into our show next week, without a vow, hopefully, a book that I've talked about with Ron about learning publicly on the radio show, a book called Chavos Levavos, Duties of the Heart, which was written by Rabbeinu Bachya, which is a wondrous book to lubricate the cogs, the wheels, the ignition system within the human mind on how we can connect to the Most High, not just with the heart, but with the mind, which is being empowered by every beat of our human heart. And I think a lot of people will find these teachings refreshing, exhilarating, empowering. So just before we move on to talking about compassion towards humanity in the Jewish tradition and the path of Raz the Gentile, Dennis, the importance of being patient. What can you tell the younger generations about the importance of being patient in this, unfortunately, too impatient world?
I can only pass on what I was told. Patience is a virtue. All virtues are good. So if we don't understand what the virtues are, then are we going about it blind people, feeling our way around, probing? It has been written, it has been said, that there are certain things that humans must follow. And those are basically virtues that we should epitomize in some way, shape, or form. Because if you don't, then your mind is going over to the dark side. You don't need that.
Amen. Now, Ron, I want to publicly acknowledge this. You are one of the greatest doctors I know because you have more patience than most people I've ever met in my whole life. So as a great doctor, how did you develop so much patience? Oh, I didn't patience...
Son, you know, you have to say on the air that, you know, this is going to be, this is actually a joke because I don't consider myself a patient person in the least. The only thing is that I've learned through experience that the only way to actually have a peaceful, contented life is through being patient. Because sometimes you rush, you run, and you end up even further back than where you started. So I've just learned that, and I try to incorporate it every day. Recently, I've been on a caffeine binge because of some research I'm doing, and I've lost all that patience that you so, you know, just praised me for. So right now I'm recovering, and I'm going through massive withdrawals from caffeine, coffee, caffeine from coffee, actually. So I must say that it's quite a virtue, as Dennis has said in all those through the years, that, you know, patience is a virtue. But when you start connecting to the Creator, you realize that you must have patience, because He's not your one stop. He's not your immediate answering machine. That as soon as you belt out a prayer or a request, it's answered to you. And many times it's through being patient and observing, then you see the hand of the Creator working things out for you. And many times sometimes it can be almost like instantaneous, and then at other times it takes almost forever. But nevertheless, during that time you're waiting, you see things unravel that if not for patience, you would miss it all. So that's my take on that.
Okay, very good. I just want to mention, I want to correct myself, that I mentioned I was promoting this Facebook group, and I called it Health-Eating Raw and Organic. It's actually Health-Living Raw and Organic. And anyone who I'm connected on Facebook, I've been just being approved by the administrator, Roger O. Berlin, to recommend people. So don't be surprised, if any out there in Facebook land, that if I recommend you, because it's a great place to dialogue and get some great information. You know, no one's going to tell you you're bad if you eat cooked food, because I continue to eat cooked food, and I even still eat a little bit of meat. And, you know, secret, I eat sometimes a little bit of junk food, but, you know, I'm a work in progress in terms of my health habits. Thank you, Ron. And we're now going to move on to the next section called Jethro's Wisdom, Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition by Rabbi David Sears. Here we go. And then we're looking forward to feedback from Dennis, Ron, and Cartrello once Cartrell comes back online with us. Jethro's Wisdom. It is remarkable that Moses, remember Moses, the author, as told by the Most High, what to write down, the author of the five books of Moses, was instructed concerning the hierarchy of leadership within the Israelite nation by his Midianite father-in-law, Jethro. The reason for this was that God wanted to show that generation of Israelites, which means for all generations, because the Torah is eternal, and all their descendants, that there are great sages among other nations. As may be seen from the advice he gave Moses, Jethro was living proof that other nations possess men of great intellect and wisdom. Thus, the Torah makes known that the Jewish people were not chosen because of their intellectual superiority, but because of God's gratuitous kindness and his love for the patriarchs. So, let's go around the table. Ron, encouraging everyone to realize that they have something in them that they might not be aware of, but if they allow it to shine, they can certainly have positive effects on society. What's your take on that, Dennis?
You addressed
Ron,
but
excuse me. We'll start with Ron and then go back to Dennis.
Okay.
Sorry.
I believe in revealing the inner you, because everyone possesses goodness, and it's just a choice they make whenever they do something that is inappropriate due to circumstances that are sometimes beyond their control. I mean, for example, environmental upbringing, but of course they are responsible for their actions, and because the thinking creations, we must think and also think of the repercussions of our actions before we actually perpetrate our action. Nevertheless, I believe personally that people are inherently good, and they just make bad decisions, they make bad choices. As a result, when talking with people, I feel it's always beneficial to always reassure them and encourage them that good that exists within them you know, it's worth revealing, and that they're possessors of true goodness. True goodness. All they have to do is believe it and reveal it.
Beautiful. Dennis, your take on these matters. Death row, wisdom, and everyone's got it. They just have to reveal it.
Well, no human knows everything. And once you understand that principle, you will understand that many minds together are more powerful than one. We as humans were not designed to be solitary. We were designed to work with other people. That's why in the basic understanding of love God and your neighbor, the assumption is made you have neighbors. Well, you must work with your neighbors. And to do that, you must have a blending of the minds and hearts. Now, if we took all the good in humanity and put it together, we would probably be able to overcome all the bad. That's my viewpoint. But if you don't use the mind of other people, then you are isolating yourself. You are not doing a service to mankind.
True. Dennis, thank you very much. Now we're going to move on to the path of the righteous Gentile, which is by Rabbi Chaim Klorfin and Rabbi Yaakov Ogalski. Ron, if you have the book in front of you, I'm going to turn to page 48, chapter 5, and now we're going to go into some specifics of the Noahide commandments, hopefully for the, you know, the continuing series of our show. And we're going to address the idea of idolatry, which might ruffle some people's feathers, but we're not here to ruffle people's feathers, but to consider this viewpoint in relation to their current faith to see if they can fine-tune their faith. Because there's actually a lot of broadness in terms of what constitutes idolatry as opposed to what people think is idolatry and really isn't idolatry, but that hopefully will be discussed at a future show. So here we go. In Chapter 5 in Idolatry, and by the way, this you'll find also a source for this in many of the teachings of Rambam in his Mishneh Torah, which we're going to hopefully be talking about in the next section, because we're going to try to give a little more time to talking about the verses 2, 16, and 17 in Genesis. So here we go. The essence of the seven Noahide universal laws is the prohibition against idolatry, which means one who worships another deity besides the Creator denies the essence of faith or / religion and rejects the entirety of the seven universal laws. But one who guards himself against idolatry demonstrates belief in God and affirms the entirety of the seven universal laws. Now, and there's a parallel teaching for Israelites, not regarding idolatry, but we'll get to that in a moment, just to tease you a little bit, because sometimes I'm a teaser. So, Ron, you're taking on this, that one commandment is an affirmation of one's faith and knowledge of the other six universal laws. What's your take on this?
Well, idolatry basically is it's a denial of the Supreme One, belief in the Supreme One, the Creator of all, and then you place your trust in something other. And he said that in the Ten Commandments, in the laws of idolatry, which is basically exactly the same as the laws of the Noahide, that there should be no God besides me. That means with me or in front of me. There should be no other. It's exclusive. It's supposed to be a totally monogamous relationship. Once that's violated, basically you've denied the sanctity of the Creator. You've denied his place as Creator. As a result, everything falls apart from there.
Beautiful. Dennis, your take on this teaching that idolatry kind of clogs up the spiritual connection one has in the other six, and let's just repeat them briefly. The first one is, of course, not to serve idols. Number two, not to blaspheme God, not to commit premeditated murder, not to steal, not to commit adultery, not to eat the limb of an animal that's still alive, and to set up courts of justice to educate foremost, and then to, as per need, to administrate over matters of wrong action against the seven universal commandments.
Well, this subject can be controversial depending on how you interpret it. However, I like the words of Jesus of Nazareth, who said, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. Render unto God what is God's." In other words, we cannot switch and match and think we can create separation of what is God's and what is man's. There's only one source, and that source must be honored as one source. So therefore, we cannot have false idols, we cannot have false gods, we cannot have a whole bunch of other false things. But at the same time, we have Maimonides, who says, well, if you use an amulet and it's beneficial, even though it has no real effect, but you think it does, then maybe there is some goodness in the amulet. He didn't intend that you can have false gods, that you can honor or use substitutions for God Almighty. He just meant, from a human viewpoint, that there are variations. But it's very clear between what is belonging to the Almighty and what belongs to humans. There is no allowance for rationalization and interpretation that you can create substitution in any form for God.
Beautiful, Dennis. And now we come to the final section of the program. We've got about 22 minutes, which we hope to conclude with a 5-minute song by David Dom. So we have about 17 minutes, so I think we have a good amount of time, and if we don't finish our discussion today, we can continue it next week, concerning the verse in Genesis 2:17, which reads, "But you shall not eat of the tree of knowledge and of good and evil, and from that day you eat of it, you will die." And the questions I raised at the beginning of the show we'll raise again, and hopefully we'll address some of them. So, again, what was that tree all about? Question number one, how do we as human beings relate to the instruction not to eat of a certain tree? And the last question I want to pose to you, blessed souls, and how does the tree of life, in contrast to the tree of knowledge of good and evil, relate to human psyche, which is intrinsically, directly configured to our divine image? So first of all, I want to mention from the Mishnah Torah, the point is brought out in the commentaries on Rambam, that although original man was commanded, original men were not commanded the prohibition of eating the limb of an animal while it was still alive, the Rambam chose to take a source, and this is just a purely academic point I want to bring out, because we learn out not directly all the seven commandments in an open way from Scripture, but rather from the oral Torah tradition. And those of you who want to learn about it more, you can go to, and they have English versions, which you go online to learn about, from the Talmudic Tractate of Sanhedrin, that's spelled Sanhedrin, and that's page 56, side A, where it said that Adam was commanded all seven precepts. Now, the Rambam, instead of quoting from Sanhedrin 56a, chose to quote from a Midrash, in Genesis Rabbah 16:6, which also mentions the seventh commandment. Now, I hope I was clear the Talmudic source says that Adam was commanded seven precepts. Rambam chose not the Talmud as a source, which probably got him in some trouble with the sage later the sages, but he chose a Midrash. Okay, now the reason is that Rambam chose the latter source is because man was explicitly, I think actually there's a misprint in my English translation, that perhaps I'd have to go back to the Sanhedrin, that Adam was commanded on six precepts, because otherwise there's no contrast here. I think the Sanhedrin is saying that Adam was commanded on six precepts and Rambam chose the seventh, but Rambam chose the latter source of the Midrash because eventually, it would be that man would be commanded not to eat the meat of an animal while it's still alive. And the Midrash, okay, derives all six prohibitions from a process of learning Torah from Genesis 2:16, where it says that man was commanded to eat from all the trees of the garden. And I'm not going to go into that, but basically, if you want to learn about it, you'd have to go to page 173 and onward in the Laws of Kings and Their Wars, which, by the way, you can access in Chapter 9. You can learn about this. You know, again, I'm going to correct myself again, blessed souls. Rambam originally said, and I'm sorry for the confusion here, I didn't properly prepare. The Talmud says that Adam was commanded on seven precepts, but I'm looking here now on the Mishneh Torah, and Rambam says he was commanded on six. So let me do a little repentance here on giving out the information in an incorrect fashion. The Talmud said that Adam was commanded on seven precepts, seven commandments. Rambam said six, as I'm looking here in the Mishneh Torah, in the beginning of chapter 9, it said six precepts, commandments were given to original man. And again, if you go to Chabad, chabad.org, and you can type in Mishneh Torah, M-I-S-H-N-A-H, and then Torah, T-O-R-A-H, you can go then to the Laws of Kings and Their Wars, and go to chapter 1, and look at these things that I'm talking about. Now, from there, from that one verse, and this is just part of the oral Torah tradition, from that one verse about, from 2:16, Rambam learns out, according to the Midrash, all of the six commandments against cursing God, murder, incest and idolatry, theft, and establishing laws and courts of justice. I just want to show that's an academic point for those who want to get more into the academic aspect of it. Of course, we're trying to make our humble efforts and presentations in some level academia, but hopefully for practical implication. But what I want to get down to the nuts and bolts, and then we'll go around with Dennis and Ron and Dennis, is the idea that not only were they told not to eat from a specific tree, was that the intention, according to the inner dimensions of Torah, is that the tree of knowledge and good of evil, in potential, could have been permissible. However, what happened was, is that the permissibility to eat from that tree of knowledge of good and evil should have been preceded by eating of the tree of life. What does that mean in terms of our experiences? That, and this is something that Dennis talks a lot about, and Rahan does as well, and I try to, is that before anything what we would call knowledge, we have to be aware of one simple basic fact and accept it, hopefully, simple faith, that we are in God's world. And in God's world, meaning to the exclusion of anything which is a creation, there is nothing but consciousness in terms of eternality. And therefore, it is a very broad and objective perspective, and its infinity, as it speaks, seems to bend people out of shape, so therefore we take on a subjective perspective which blocks the light of eternal consciousness and endless consciousness, which is part and parcel, and even still is not the ultimate description of the Creator. He just is. He is God. So I want to go around now the table. I mean, this is not the simplest of concepts to be shared, but something we can hopefully chew on and digest and help other people digest it. Dennis, the idea of contrasting what is normally to be seen as, you know, they weren't supposed to eat from that fruit of knowledge of good and evil, that fruit of knowledge of good and evil, as opposed to perhaps they could have been allowed to eat it if first they had imbibed first with a greater perspective, an internalized greater perspective. First, when you start with a godly consciousness of the one Creator, then you can deal with the objective perspective of eternity, and we are part of an eternal process. Then we can deal with the differentiation, which is associated with subjective consciousness.
Don, I'd like to take credit for the obvious, and that is trees are innocent. Trees are part of Mother Nature. Trees
right.
don't have morality to them. Trees
right.
are there for humans to enjoy. However, I think most of the writings are symbolic of trees representing something. But trees per se are only trees. So let's not take it out on the trees because they did nothing wrong. However, as it's mentioned and referenced in ancient writings, is that it's symbolic. And that symbolic has strong meaning to it. So let's not quibble about the language when the meaning is clear. The content is there. The purpose is clear. One other thing I'd like to say is that when Rambam gives a rendering or his interpretation of something, I listen to whatever he does because he is unique in describing things and he has a lot more knowledge than most other human beings. So when two people who I like to understand and believe in, not only Maimonides but also Onkelos, these are people who went back to the ancient writings and decided what would be the best understanding for all to come. And believe it or not, they have withstood the test of time. So, yes, I believe.
Ron, the teachings I was plucking out of was from this Chumash, this one of the five books of Moses, the book of Genesis, that you had clued me in on almost a year ago. The idea of if they had eaten from the tree of life, they had gotten the internalized, first objective eternal consciousness, they would have been able to deal with the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And by the tree, as Dennis mentioned, the tree of knowledge of good and evil did no wrong. It was put by there, it was put in the Garden of Eden to test the consciousness and the sensitivities of original man and woman. So, Ron, what's your take on the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil?
Before I get into that one, that question, previously when you spoke about the Rambam mentioning the seven Noahide commandments as opposed to the Talmud, which mentioned six.
Well, actually, I made a mistake. It was the Talmud mentioned seven, Rambam mentioned six.
Okay.
I kind of fumbled on that one.
All right. No, the reason I came across this also, and it was because there's a teaching that originally Adam was not given the permission to kill animals for food. As a result, that law, by some sages, they feel that law was not applicable for him at that time. That's
right.
Why it wanted six. And later on, after Noah was given permission to slaughter animals for food, then that seventh was applied, the law of eating the limb from a living animal. So it's not really it's not really controversial. It's just because of the different times and what took place. Back to your question, the tree of life is actually the Torah. And if they had eaten from that first, they would have acquired a Torah perspective. So acquiring the knowledge of good and evil afterward, it would have been affected by their knowledge of Torah in a, before. So as a result, we have the exact same opportunities now as Adam and Eve, whereas we have the Torah and we can look into that. We can use the Torah to, in terms of acquiring its knowledge and of right and wrong. As a result, now that we have knowledge of good and evil, we know how to make the proper choices.
Beautiful. I just want to mention. Yes, Dennis.
I'd just like to make a point that's a pet thing of mine, and that is whether it's 6, 7, 5, 4, 3, 2, or 100. The number is unimportant. The purpose, the intent, and the ultimate understanding is far more important than how many numbers are involved. And we must believe and honor the purpose, the content, and the understanding.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's the Dennis. I mean, ultimately, it's not about the numbers. It's about how do we apply our knowledge to our actual thought, speech, and action in our daily lives. And there are plenty of angels up in heaven who know how to count better than us, will be able to testify as to what good in terms of quantity and quality we're engaging, as opposed to our, you know, I mean, by we the Jewish people, we stand firm on 613, and we also advocate the nation's will to observe the seven, which Ron can easily tell you, and I can tell you just as well, that it's really more than just seven. Again, if we get too much into linear thinking, then we can really mess up our consciousness. And I just want to kind of like plug back into what I was mentioning before, plucking from this book on commenting on these verses in 216 and 217, that actually we shouldn't think that the experience or the test that original man and woman went through in those days is something which doesn't apply to us. The truth is, every morning we start our life anew, in the sense that we're kind of resurrected. Sleep is actually considered from Talmudic teachings to be 1/60th of death. So when we're waking up each morning, we're experiencing 1/60th of the resurrection of that part of that 1/60th of us that was dead. And how many of us, and I speak of myself as before anyone, our first waking moment, is it really dedicated about reinforcing our consciousness of God's infinity, of his absolute reality that encompasses all finite reality within it? And only then, when we start our first waking moment, and again, it's not easy, what would help, I would humbly suggest, is to meditate upon the Most High's infinity as you lay down to sleep at night, blessed souls. And therefore, when we wake up, if we wake up with our first moment of thinking about he is truly one, he is infinite, can we proceed more safely with the rest of our daily activities of evaluating and sifting through the issues of life? And all of us have issues we have to sift through in our daily lives based on our perception of what is good and what is evil. So what we humbly suggest to every human being, each one according to their blessing, is to begin each day with a prayer. And I'm not saying how much, again, it's only a suggestion, to suggest to every person to start the day of prayer to want to connect to this eternal creator, and each one according to their blessing to engage in Torah study, whether it be written or oral traditions. And therefore we are empowered to fulfill God's intention that we taste of the tree of eternal life before tasting of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Dennis, and then Ron, what are your you have about 2 minutes apiece to share your wonderful opinions.
Yeah. I'll make it quick, Don. Every day we wake up is another chance to do good.
Ron, you're taking this on this challenge every day when we wake up. Do we think about God's infinity or about, I got a car bill or a telephone bill to pay?
Well, first of all, we just have to, once we're given that our souls back, we should thank the Creator for that. And with that that type of thinking, we go through a day feeling only a feeling of gratitude towards the Creator. And this keeps us feeling that indebtedness to Him, which facilitates the feeling of keeping in tune with what He wants. Understand? So I feel once you begin that day of showing gratitude, it should flow through the rest of the day in your consciousness and subconsciousness. So
I hear you. Okay, gentlemen, you know what? Guess what? It looks like we've come to the end of the show, and hopefully next week. Now, I might not be available. I'm just letting you know. Next Sunday, Dennis, would you be available on Labor Day?
Yes, I'm a 24/7 guy.
Ron, are you available or are you working on Labor Day?
I am working on Labor Day.
Okay, so it looks like it will be the dynamic duo D&D, Dennis and Don, without the Ron. Hopefully on Labor Day, hopefully we'll post up in the next day or two, Dennis, when we'll go on. I'll talk to you about it. But I want to make in my concluding statements, blessed souls, that it's enough for us, blessed souls, to remember that it's important for us never to overestimate our negative traits. And please don't underestimate the goodness within you. If the Creator created you, there's a lot of good within you, and it's up for you to do that excavation. You know, they're finding discoveries all the time in the world, but each person is an Olam Katan, a small world. Take the time to discover the good within yourself and see what you can implement. And it could be the tiniest, babyest action, a baby step, as we call it in the mental health field. Take a baby step once you realize another good aspect of yourself. And by the way, I was taught this by my Rav Zichron Alav Hashalom, one of my foremost teachers in my formative years in Judaic studies, is that when you feel you can do something better than you ever did before, you're experiencing what is known as a gila nefesh, a revelation of your soul. So the more you come to realize your good points, blessed souls, the more you can implement it into practical action of doing good for this world, the more revelations of your soul powers you will experience in this world. And with that being said, I want to conclude the show, of course, with a song by Blessed Brother in Arms and soul, David Dunn from England. The song is called It's Enough. So I guess it's enough of the show we've had today. I just want to conclude, as usual, with Ahav Echad, one love, Goril Echad, one destiny of Kolano for all of us, Bardarchi Shalom, in a peaceful way, Bardarchi Nom, in a pleasant way, Laham Sheikh, to be continued, Be'ezet Hashem, with the help of Hashem, Yisbrech, may be blessed, and may we all be blessed to come again together, bless ourselves, on another edition of Soul Class in Search of of Ancient Authentic Torah, which will be moving on to Genesis verse 2, verse 18, and plus all the stuff we like to talk about on a weekly basis, plus integrating the duties of the heart and going into the attribute of patience according to the teachings of Breslov Chassidus. Take care, everyone. It's enough that I've spoken. Take care. Thank you.